So my cocktail tonight is going to have preserved lemons in it. That was the thing that spoke to me in World Market this week.
Oh my goodness.
And the lady at the counter is like, "What is this for?" She was like, "What do you do with this?" And I was like, "Well, I'm making a cocktail with it, but I think I'm going to try and put it on pizza and stuff." And I was like, "I wonder if that's just like what her job is filled with, because like it's literally the World Market."
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
it's like so many things that it's like, "Yeah, what do I do with this?"
What do I use this ingredient in? Yeah, there's several times I'll like Google like paint like a color, blue cocktails, and let them just I just look at all of them and let them like try to like fill me with joy today. Today's is a little less joyful, a little less colorful. It is dark black, my cocktail.
Fine with me. It
Crazy.
looks very fall. We're getting into the season. The leaves
We
are
are.
falling.
I had a pumpkin spice latte today.
No way. Did you go to Starbucks?
Yeah.
I went to a Starbucks and I like never go.
Did they give you stickers? They
No.
gave me a sheet of pumpkin spice
What?
latte
Well, I
stickers.
got a honey crisp
Oh, okay.
one
So
because
that's
like
why.
yeah.
I've had that one.
But
That's
I
good.
was kind of mad though because I was like, "Oh, I'd like you like the honey crisp latte or whatever." He goes, "Do you want a macchiato?" And I was like, "No, I want a latte." I was like, "They're," which from my understanding, they are essentially the same thing,
Yeah.
except a macchiato, the espresso gets poured over top and not in the bottom.
You're like, I
Like
said what I said.
I
I ordered a
said, but also it's
latte.
like, why can't you just do that for me?
Right.
No, I don't want a macchiato. I want a latte.
Yes.
I don't know.
That's
Again,
what I
not that there's
want.
any difference, but
Not
it's
that's
like,
what I want.
but that's what I ordered. I don't
Right.
know.
Yeah.
But the people at Starbucks are wonderful. They are under a lot of pressure, especially in the fall. So,
And a lot of people don't know what these words mean. A
yes.
lot of people.
But anyways, we're not here to talk about coffee. We're here to talk about herstory with Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we are not historians. We do a lot of research. We do what we can do, but sometimes we mess up and then you guys fix it and it's totally fine.
Yes, it's wonderful. And you can comment, you can send us emails, or you can join our Patreon for as
I
little.
love our Patreon group.
Our Patreon's the best. For as little as $1 a month, you can come and hang out with us and other people who like the show, and you get a little bit extra audio every week where we talk about things that are way too personal sometimes.
Mostly our Patreon is like personal therapy sesh. Like we say things and people are like, it'll be okay. Like that's most of it.
I'm sure last week was like that because we just like dumped about all the stuff that's been going on in our personal lives. But yeah, it's great. So if you want, join us over there or you can rate and review us. I always say this at the end, but I was like, I need to start doing it at the beginning a little bit
Yeah,
to
please.
remind
Thank
people.
you. Please.
It'd be the best because we haven't gotten a review since like
And
February.
guess what? I love compliments. It's
Yes.
actually my love language, words of
It's true.
affirmation. So if you could affirm me, thank you. I'd love
Thank
that.
you. But
Well, but you're busy.
yes, you are busy.
Hopefully typing us a
Yes.
freaking review.
That would be lovely. So you're doing that. So you don't want to get on a new web page and look up what these women look like. So we're going to do you a favor. We're going to describe what they look like. We're going to get a little
Physical, physical.
Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I'm doing Tallulah Bankhead.
A legend.
What a banger. What a legend. She famously had short flapper hair that changed colors through the decades. It was brown. It was dirty blonde. It was gray as she aged. She had a deeply hooded eye that worked great on stage, but really lacked on film sometimes. She wore a deep red lip throughout her career that is even evident in the black and white photos and footage. She had a slender build during her career, and she did not mind showing off her body, even uninvited, and famously said about her, "Her face is like an evil flower. She's so intense, she vibrates. She's one of the most violently beautiful women I've ever seen."
Oh my gosh.
That's Tallulah Bankhead.
I always picture like Cate Blanchett in my head when I think of her.
I can see some similarities
I feel
there,
like they give
yeah.
off similar
Yeah,
vibes.
yeah, yeah.
Okay, I am doing Dr. Margaret Chung. Margaret was a Chinese American woman with a round face, kind eyes, and a wide smile. When she was in medical school, she could be seen wearing a suit and slicked back hair, looking very masculine. But then she traded that look in for a white doctor's coat, and eventually she could be seen in a naval uniform with round glasses, surrounded by military souvenirs, photos, and letters gifted to her by her many sons.
What a doctor lady. What a doctor boss lady.
The pictures of her are, like, she is so proud when she's, like, in this room with all these things, which we'll get into, like, that whole thing, obviously, in my story. But
but that's second half.
That's second half.
We got to start here. Yes. Start small. Do you want to know what you're drinking?
I do.
Okay, so I went way beyond star for this one.
Okay.
This is supernova.
Ooh,
that's what this is. Because okay. This woman was not just a traditional Hollywood mm-hmm. star. I think a supernova is just a type of star, but it sounded good.
Yeah.
So this is a take on the Black Velvet, which Black Velvet is a cocktail that has Guinness in it. Mm-hmm. So this is literally half a champagne flute of champagne and half a champagne flute of Guinness.
All right.
It's going to be really good. I promise you.
Cheers.
Isn't that interesting?
Why is that good?
I don't know, but
when you were making it, I was like, what the hell
is
she
doing? So I went to this not this place, I went to the Guinness restaurant like 5 minutes from my house, mm-hmm. and they have a whole list mm-hmm. of cocktails made with their beer, mm-hmm. And they had a take on this with like some other ingredients, and I was like, at its base it literally is champagne and Guinness, and it's so good.
Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
And it's so easy to make.
I know, yeah.
All you have to do is not overflow the glass. Yeah.
That's the trick.
That is the trick, because both of these are bubbly. Okay. Tell me what you know about Tallulah Bankhead.
Okay. I know she was an actress.
Sure was.
And I know she was, like, famously queer and sexual.
Oh,
like, she was just, like, a sexual being and very in tune with herself in that regard. And really, like, that's all I know. I could not even name a movie she was in, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I, like, feel bad, but, like, I feel like, okay, she's the type of old Hollywood where, like, whenever they make an old Hollywood movie, they're like, oh, that's Tallulah Bankhead.
Yeah.
But I don't know what actually she did. She was just there in my head.
Yeah. She just, like, existed.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I, for this research, like, I typed Tallulah Bankhead bio into YouTube and watched, like, all 30 million like bios about her, because there are just so many stories.
Yeah.
Every celebrity has a story about her. They mm-hmm. all mention her in their like little in interviews or like movies they were in with her, plays yeah. they were in with her. So there's just so many like little stories, and I mm-hmm. tried to pick the best one. So if I miss your favorite Tallulah Bankhead story, I'm sorry. So I did that. And then obviously I watched read the Wikipedia and uh-huh. read her like fandom page.
Oh, perfect.
So Tallulah Bankhead was born on January 31st, 1902, in the twilight of the grandeur of Southern aristocracy. She was the second daughter of Will, who was born in Ireland, and Adelaide Bankhead. Her parents met while her mom was out shopping for a wedding dress when she was engaged to another man. And they fell in love at first sight, and ugh. She, like, got rid of those plans and married Will instead.
I love stories like that. I feel bad for, like, the person that gets left, but it's happened a couple times in Casey's family.
They meet somebody while they're engaged to somebody else?
Yes.
Cool. Cool. Cool.
Like, literally, like, while they're at, like, an event with some, like, another date. And then, like, they sweep them away.
I mean, it's just the chemistry yes. must be, like, electric in situations like that. She does have one older sister about a year older than her named Eugenia, who's also a very interesting person and lived in like Chesterfield, Maryland for a while.
No way.
Yeah. So okay. That's actually where Tallulah is buried. We could drive to her grave. It's on like Kent Island.
Oh my gosh.
It's like an hour and 30 minutes from here.
Yeah.
I'm like on the way to Ocean City next time I'm going.
I should pop in.
Yeah. It's just at it's like in a church graveyard. You yeah. can just like walk in. Her mother. Tallulah was born on her mom and dad's second anniversary, wedding anniversary. But her mother, just like weeks after her birth, dies.
No.
And her famous final request of her sister was, look after Eugenia. Tallulah will look after herself. Which she was only 3 months old. So that's so like prophetic
yeah.
because Tallulah is going to be this resilient, rebellious spirit. But her dad doesn't deal with this well. He's a member of, at this time, the Alabama State Legislature. He ends up, I think, in the House of Reps for like the whole country. Her uncle ends up in the Senate, and he baptizes Tallulah next to her mother's coffin, an act which really connected the joy from her life with like the misery of losing his wife. Like, he was crushed. He was like very in love with her. And alcohol begins to fuel his melancholy.
Oh no. Some, you said couldn't deal with that. I thought you meant like Tallulah's rebellious nature, but you meant the death of his wife.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
This is so sad.
And like he, Tallulah remembers him like saying in like fits of rage, like he wanted to take his own life to join his wife in the afterlife. And she's like a young kid while this is happening. He's also kind of unable to care for the daughters by himself because he's like in government, working in government. So he shipped them off and shuffled them around to aunts and grandparents along the way. At her aunt's home, we've mentioned this before, she found camaraderie with Zelda Sayre, later Fitzgerald.
Oh my gosh, I forgot they had a connection.
Best friends. They're best friends when she was at her aunt's house because they were both tomboys that loved mischief and running around and rough and tumble like down in the Alabama South, like just picturing them together. And then that they both go on to be these amazing like flapper icons, yeah, I think is great. Tallulah still, however, had a very deep jealousy for her older sister's beauty and charm and the love that their father doted on her. He had really wanted a son with this second baby, and it didn't help that Tallulah was kind of extremely homely as a child. She wasn't like a super cute kid, and she wasn't slim and like gorgeous like her older sister. She doubled down then on being a tomboy to get her dad's affection. She would jump off roofs. She would fearlessly confront anybody who crossed her. She pretended to be in the circus. She rolled around and had screaming tantrums. She did cartwheels. She would hold her breath until she turned blue. And like her grandmother would have to throw buckets of water on her to get her to stop. Like, she was nuts. And at 5 years old, her dad's like, oh my gosh, we got to get this girl out of the house and have her do something. So we took her to her first vaudeville performance. She was enchanted by the stage. And she began mimicking the actors' sultry voices and body language all around the house. And in fact, Bankhead has this like husky, deep voice that she called mezzo basso late into her career. And it was a result of always having chronic bronchitis when she was a child. Yeah. So she has this like really deep, sexy voice. One night, after her dad had been out drinking, he places Tallulah on the table to do her performance, because she's always performing around the house. And all of his drinking friends were like hooting, hollering, cheering for her and whatever. And this performance ignited her lifelong crave of the spotlight. Later in her memoir, she said, "The cheering of a crowd did things to my spine, to my mind. I've often tingled to applause, but never did I have such tingles as that night."
I've heard that, like, when you know you're supposed to, like, do this for the rest of your life, like, you become addicted to it.
Yeah,
like
it hits.
Yeah.
And, like, one of her early performances, like, as a kid, the Wright brothers were there.
What?
They were just, like, there, you know, because their dad's in government, you know, they're wheeling and dealing with a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess they're in the South. Wow. Yeah. That is wild.
Yeah. So at 10 years old, Tallulah's dad, like, could not deal with her rebellious spirit anymore, so he sent her to a convent school in New York. Tallulah was restless and homesick, and she couldn't focus on her lessons, and she hated all the rules, and she was getting punished all the time. And most of the girls in her class were Northerners and looked down on her from being from the South. Like, she was kind of a Southern bimbo. And she would try to make the girls laugh. She would, you know, parade naked around the dorm room or tell crude jokes, but they just curled their lips in disdain at her. They did not like it. And the more annoying she became, the more they like excluded her, and then the more they excluded her, the worse behaved she was. Like,
oh,
she just
my gosh.
It was this tumbling effect. And at the end of the term, they would do this thing where all the best behaved girls would wear a white veil and carry white lilies into like the final service, and they excluded Tallulah and made her wear a black veil all by herself and walk in.
Oh my god.
And she is weeping the entire time.
That's traumatizing.
Yeah. She's a middle schooler. That's horrible.
I hate that.
After this, she was sent to a succession of other schools, and she was either expelled or had to move. She and her sister were slowly moving in schools closer to D.C. because her dad was moving up from being in Alabama legislature to being in Washington, D.C. But also, she would get kicked out for smoking or drinking or climbing out of the dorm room to meet boys or throwing an inkwell at Mother Superior. She was just riotous. It wasn't helping that she was in a really awkward phase. Like I said earlier, she was not considered beautiful. When puberty hit, she got plump, she had a ton of acne, and she started laying around longing to look like the women in the magazines. These beautiful stars, these actresses are so pretty. She thought, just if I could look like Zelda, just if I could look like my sister, then I would be famous. She thought she'd have no problem. But at 15, and there's kind of two ways this story is told. At 15, either her new stepmother, who her dad married a new woman, or her aunt started to help her. I venture to guess it's probably both of them started to help her. And they were like, look, grow your hair out a little longer. Let's pick out the food you're supposed to eat so your skin's not as oily. Let's help you lose some weight, get an exercise routine. And within a few months, she had dropped 20 pounds. Her acne had subsided. And it's all kind of due to this better diet.
Well, and also, like, it's probably just someone paying attention to her.
She never had a mother. She didn't have a mother.
Oh, my gosh. Like, because, like, I feel like that would also take care of some of these, like, behavioral issues. It's, like,
love?
Kids that are doing that just, like, a lot of times, like, just need someone to just pay attention. Literally any kind
any,
of attention.
Any attention. Like good morning, Tallulah. How are you today? Like, that would be nice. That would be really, really nice.
And obviously, like, some kids that are doted upon also become rebellious monsters. But... Yeah.
Sometimes that's because they're too doted upon. You have to have the right recipe of doting, everyone. Yes. Figure it out.
And then it'll be perfect.
And then and then report back to me.
Yeah. When you find out what it is.
Right. So then she sees this magazine near her house that's running a beauty contest. And Tallulah gets so excited. Readers are invited to send in photographs, and the prize is going to be a film role in New York. So she borrows a hat and a fox stole and is just like, oh my gosh, this picture's so good, that she mails it in, forgets to write her name on it.
Oh my gosh.
Because, Tallulah. 3 months later, she's in the drugstore near her house flipping through a magazine, and she sees the photo of herself with 12 other winners with a headline that says, "Who is she?" And beneath it, it's like, "Help us unmask this beauty. Like, make yourself known."
What a dream. I know. Oh, my God.
Excuse me. Where's my magazine? Where's my secret magazine?
I'm glad she didn't write her name on it. Like,
what a better story. What a better story. So she ran out of the drugstore screaming, like, I've won it. I've won. You know, she's so excited. She thinks this is her big break. Her father objected at first, but mostly it was financial. So she had to convince her grandfather to help fund this trip and stay in New York. And she also needed a chaperone. So her Aunt Louise stepped in to be chaperone because her marriage had recently broke up and she had lost a child. So she was like, okay, I'll go to New York and help her out. Also, like, Tallulah, when they told her she couldn't go, was being super dramatic and threatening hunger strikes. Like, you know, she's just being a regular old Tallulah. But her aunt definitely was too depressed to deal with a spirited girl like Tallulah in New York. Yeah. Her dad told her when she left, watch out for booze and boys. And then she headed out to New York. And it wasn't all that it was cracked up to be. When she got there, the part in the film she was supposed to be with had been shut down. Ew. So she kind of had to shop around a little bit and finally found a really small part that was, like, barely even a side character in the comedy Who Loved Him Best. She was not even an extra. And there's two stories again here. Some people say she was paid a $25 check and she ripped it up because it was so fun to be in the play. She wasn't worth it. And other people said she got $75 for 3 weeks and it helped her stay in New York to find her niche. I think a lot of her stories are just, like, exploded.
Yeah.
And are partially true in both ways.
Yes.
She might have, like, torn up half of the money or something. I don't know.
Or, like, if it was $75, like, maybe that first check she tore up.
Right.
And then she's like, oh.
Oh, wait, I really need this.
I do need this.
I need money to live here.
I will take the last two checks.
Without knowing the importance of it, her aunt had gotten them a room in the Algonquin Hotel. This was a place crawling with the Broadway crowd. She is surrounded on a nightly basis by Anne Andrews and Douglas Fairbank Jr. and all three Barrymore siblings and Hayward Brown and Dorothy Parker. And, you know, the first time she says that she was in an elevator alone with Ethel Barrymore, she was like, I had to lean against the wall for support. This is how she recounts that day about Ethel. Her imperious manner, the scorn in her voice, the contempt of her eyes, the great reputation in which she was cloaked made a violent impact on me.
A violent impact.
Violent impact.
I love that.
She was dubbed in Algonquin one of the four riders of Algonquin, consisting of four young ladies, only three of whom were not heterosexual. So there was only one heterosexual, like, party hopper among them. Mm-hmm. Ethel Barrymore did try to get her to change her name to Barbara, but it was in Vanity Fair later that she found out she was happy she didn't change her name. Vanity Fair said she was the only actress on both sides of the Atlantic to be recognized by only a first name.
Yeah.
So Ethel was like, Tallulah's a little weird. Maybe change it. And she decided not to, and it was a good thing.
Yeah.
She attended after-show parties in the Algonquin restaurant, because this is prohibition, so, like, they're not drinking in bars. She's just in the restaurant. She would weasel her way in. She would flirt and clown around. She would have jumped off a cliff to get these people's attention, and she ended up being kind of a little pet to the famous people. They thought she had vitality, and she was, like, intoxicating, but her aunt felt differently. She did not like that Tallulah kept sneaking out to go and smoke and hang out with these people. So her aunt left to go to the Red Cross effort for World War I. So she was replaced by two other aunts in succession who both couldn't deal with her. So in the end, they decided to just leave her 17-year-old self in New York and just trust her.
Well, because honestly, they're like, she's doing what she's doing, whether we're here or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like what else is there to do other than drag her home? And then, like, she's already got the taste.
Right.
For this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. She's going to go back kicking and screaming.
Like, yeah, there's no way you could get her out of there at this point. She would have been riotous.
Yeah.
And for 17, it didn't help that she was absurdly, forwardly sexual. And, like, not, like, necessarily always in her behavior, just in her look, in the way she sat, in the way she carried herself. She just, like, was a very sexual aura coming off of her.
She reminds me a lot of, like, a Blanche Devereaux.
Yes.
From the Golden Girls.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just very, like, Blanche.
No matter what they're doing, like, that is at the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, like, this raw sexual energy.
Yeah, the sexual nature of her.
Yeah.
Tallulah was delighted by her own beauty and the permission it gave her to flirt and always get her way. And although she loved beauty and flirting, she had not yet engaged in sex. She did get close a few times in the beginning, but ultimately refused most men. All men, actually, up to this point. She said, "My dad warned me about men and booze, but he didn't warn me about women and cocaine."
Oh!
Uh-huh.
I was not prepared for that last bit.
At the time during Prohibition, cocaine was legal and unregulated, and most people used it as a substitute for alcohol.
Really?
And as a stimulant for, like, a euphoric high, and it gave her energy to go on endless auditions all the time.
I did not know that.
Her first real affair was with a young European actress. It only lasted a few months, and frankly, all of her first affairs were with women, most of them older than herself. Mm-hmm. She was very unsure about men. Especially John Barrymore offered to give her a role in the film Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde if she agreed to have sex with him, and he, like, exposed his penis to her, and she refused. She walked away from the role. And friends at the hotel knew that this had taken place, so they soon got her a role as an understudy in a major play. And when the main actress wasn't there, she got to perform.
Oh, my gosh.
So helpful.
Yeah.
Then she was offered the part in Footloose, which earned her recognition from the New York Times as being powerful and a real skill.
I'm sorry. Footloose.
Yeah, so a play.
A play.
A play.
Is this play
No idea.
Any way to do it? Okay.
No idea. I imagine it is. I imagine okay. Footloose the movie is a retelling of the play, but it's probably a different type of story.
Yeah. Maybe like the same bones or something.
Right. Like the not being able to dance and wanting to dance. Sounds like a stage play to me. you know what I mean? And then she got a lead in the play, The Nice People. And Tallulah was kind of the new type of hero in these plays, with short skirts and cigarettes and an independent attitude. Mm. And again, that deep, sexy voice that mm-hmm. thrived on sexual innuendos. Her best role, though, at this time was in molding herself off stage to the New York City crowd. She was a natural exhibitionist. She did outrageous stunts and jokes. She would cartwheel around parties without panties on just to like get attention, and she would introduce herself and then say, "I'm a lesbian, what do you do?" And she remarked that in New York she was as pure as the driven slush. And famously, I think this is an Oscar Wilde quote that she dressed up. She said, "I don't give a fuck what people say about me as long as they say something." Her one-liners, man.
They're so good.
They steal the show. She ended up getting a large group of fanatical fans. Like, they were crazy about her. And, like, Tallulah was kind to them. In one instance, she met somebody on the street and she gave them the coat off her back. Mm. She did a few silent stills. Silent films at this time, but she was just better on stage. And these were not commercial successes, even though the critics kind of liked her in them. Then she meets George Napier, who is better known as Napes. This is her first love affair with a male. He is a real baron. He has a taste for men and women equally, kind of just like she does. He's visiting New York. With this reputation to coming to the opera and bringing sailors with him and seducing, you know, the footman at the Vanderbilt Hotel. And she resisted him at first, but then very quickly fell head over heels for him mm-hmm. and was like, "He's going to marry me." She really believes this. Again, she's like not even 20 yet.
Oh my God.
"He's going to marry me." He has a streak of cruelty in his lovemaking. He liked to draw a little blood in bed. He liked bruises. He liked being bruised himself. He was sometimes gentle, sometimes malicious, and then he would just disappear for weeks at a time. And he'd be like, "Oh, okay, I'm going back to England." And she'd be like heartbroken. And like the thing she said about him is like loving him was like both torture but also super euphoric. Mm. Like I think she loved the crazy nature of it because he was unpredictable, like a puzzle she couldn't put together. Mm-hmm. But then he's going back to England and just like, "Okay, I guess I see you around whenever I see you." And she met British director Charles Cochran, and he goes, "You want to come to London to be in this play?" And she's like, "Oh, that's where Napes is. That's important." And also she got the backing of an astrologer who was like, "Yes, go to England, honey." She got an old friend of her grandfather to help pay for the trip because she always immediately spent all the money she had. Mm-hmm. She did not save any money. Mm-hmm. And a crowd of cheerful flappers waved her goodbye as she went off on her boat. So at 21 years old, she's never left America before, and she's on a boat to London. When she got there, the play was already cast. So she got Cochran, the guy who invited her. She's like, "Take me to the director." And he's like, "Sorry, we already have someone." But he had a weakness for glamorous women, so she showed up the next day in her only evening dress with her hair spilling down her back. And the director's daughter said, "Daddy, that's the most beautiful girl I've ever seen in my life." So she got the role. But the play started in a month. She was under a ton of pressure. The cast resented an American walking in and taking the lead role. Mm. And when she asked where the toilets were one day, they all like scoffed at her because it was inappropriate or cross to say that back then. So this was just like being back in the convent school.
Yeah.
Opening night, she wept all through the first interval, believing she was a huge failure. But as it turned out, everyone loved her and the reviews were great. The name Tallulah was exotic to the public, and she was this young, beautiful woman that came out of nowhere, and everybody starts storming to the gallery mm-hmm. seats, especially the young flapper women. She's becoming like a flapper heroine. And when she cut her hair off in the flapper style, her fans used to come to the show, wait for the encore, cut their hair off, and then throw it on the stage.
Oh,
at
my
her
gosh.
Feet.
I love that. It's so empowering. It's almost like she's like a pretty woman. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like that kind of thing of like, you made it, girl. Like,
we love you.
You're a flapper like us, and now you're a big money star.
You're on the stage.
In a respectable play.
Right. And then, I mean, she had gone there to find Napes. So she meets with him at the Ritz. He bought her a dog to make up with her. And she was like, okay, you don't need to apologize, whatever. But she also had to accept that he had a new boyfriend named Edward. And she would be regularly seen out on the town with both men, Napes and Edward. And just like the time in New York City, he would disappear for long periods of time. So she would go on to do like all these socialite parties and things without mm-hmm. him. She had no idea how many lovers he had behind her back. And this is when she starts to get close with Olga Lynn. Olga Lynn, she describes as the most divine woman. She was maternal in nature to Tallulah. This move was great. She moves into Olga's house. The actress worked in the British theater. People weren't highly paid, so she helped Tallulah get out of debt. Tallulah didn't understand. First of all, she spent all her money. And second of all, she didn't understand the pound to dollar exchange rate. So she was just like being nuts. Olga helped her with that. She helped get her back on a diet. She helped design her wardrobe. She introduced her to the ladies and men of society, to playboys and politicians, and to the Churchills. And then when Tallulah's dad came to London to visit, she got to introduce him to these people. And he was like so proud of her, which is all she ever wanted.
Oh my gosh.
And that play that she was in was called The Dancers. After that closed, she struggled through a whole bunch of really crappy plays. Like she had to act with a monkey. So she's relying mostly on her off-screen one-liners that she shouts in the street to like keep her famous. Yeah. Like she's at a party and this guy's staring at her and she said, "What's the matter? You don't recognize me with my clothes on?"
Oh.
Tallulah, stop it.
I also like the thing about her too is like I know that it's pure. Like if it were me, I'd be like up late, like writing down these.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
no,
like, okay, I'm gonna wait until the perfect moment, then I'll say it.
This is quick wit.
Like,
this is just quick wit.
Just so quick like that,
and crass, and like I can't believe she wasn't getting in trouble for this. She's out talking about being a lesbian, talking about all these sexual partners. She is not married, and is just getting away with it. This is like the 1950s.
I don't know. I don't know if it's like, I mean.
Maybe it was so much that everybody was like, that's Tallulah.
Yeah.
Like, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know? I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
It's crazy. She was also a really terrible driver, which added to her notoriety. When she was in London, she bought herself a Bentley and she would often get lost on the London streets and telephone a taxi to come and drive in front of her to show her how to get home. People thought she was free of inhibition and all swagger and stut. But later in her memoirs, she said, any minute I knew my clock might strike 12. So yeah. I was just going for it. She's drinking. She's doing drugs. She's having affairs with everybody in the London elite. And she really did think that Napes would marry her eventually. But she's like, well, in the meantime. And when someone asked if she was ever engaged to him at any point, she said, only I thought I was.
Oh my gosh.
The first time she felt pregnant was in the mid-1920s. Olga had a nurse inject her with a saline solution. This is a painful and dangerous way to have an abortion. It was very bloody. She was bedridden for 2 weeks. Ugh. She had, after this one, three more abortions by the time she was 30, with a total of four in her life. And they were all very dangerous. But again, she openly publicized it, saying things like, I'll never go back to that place again where they aborted me with bloody nails and old razor blades. And people just let her get away with saying things like that.
Oh my
she was
gosh.
So outspoken.
Yeah.
But she needed better roles. She wasn't getting the roles she needed to pay for herself. She needed ones with guts where people could really get into who she was. So she found this play that's based on the Somerset story called Rain, and its central character is a young sex worker who makes a bond with a religious zealot. And she wanted to do it so bad, but the director said that she lacked personality. And she, like, publicly was like, I don't want you in this play. And she was so embarrassed and publicly shamed that she scribbled a goodbye note and swallowed 20 aspirin.
No.
She did wake up the next day with a really bad headache and very, very sick. But she was just, like, a fallen angel. Like, you know, she was offered kind of role after role of just like shitty stuff, and she would take like these parts, but her comic delivery was like too effective in some places or not effective in other places. But then sometimes she would get in a show and people would howl with delight, and she was like, the critics would love her. Yeah. So it really just like depended on the night, I feel like.
Yeah.
But as the decade drew to a close, she's almost 30. Napes had gone off and married the daughter of an earl. She has no money because she spent all of it. She finds out that Paramount is looking for beautiful stage actresses because they have started talkies.
Oh, my God.
So Paramount's like, we'll give you $50,000 a week if you, like, come and act in all of our movies. And the exotic Tallulah with the husky voice would prove to be wonderful at this. She was in, you know, about a half dozen films or so and made quite a bit of money doing lots of different things. She's leaping from buildings. She's in a submarine. She's begging in the streets. And people, no matter, just like on stage, no matter what, people were like, either you're a waste of talent, you should be doing something bigger, or you don't live up to your hype. Nobody would ever just give her like the middle road. Mm-hmm. And also on screen, like her eyes, she was a big actor. She didn't have good face acting. So when they would do close-up shots, people didn't really feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as if being in a movie caged her, like the little stuff. After 8 years of pretty decent success in London, she really hated this time in Hollywood. And she like was in films with like very famous people like Joan Crawford, right? Like they worked together. And Joan Crawford said, we all adored her. We were fascinated by her, but we were scared to death of her, too. She had such authority, as if she ruled the earth, as if she was the first woman on the moon.
Wow.
From Joan Crawford, who we know is notoriously her own type of bitch. And like Tallulah walked into a party and like publicly apologizes to Joan. I'm sorry I slept with your wife, your husband, but you'll be next. To Joan Crawford. And she's like, I'm straight. Oh, like, I don't know what we're talking about here. And I mean, she often did things like say, darling. Oh, by the way, the darling, the Cruella de Vil darling, comes from her. I read that in one source.
Excellent.
Disney, you can check me. Darling, the main reason I accepted the part was to fuck the divine Gary Cooper. Like, she was taking roles in films to, like, get with guys. But then there was a big blow. She talked to a magazine reporter while she's working for Paramount. And she goes, I haven't had an affair in 6 months. 6 months is too long. I need a man. And they publish it. And her family in the South is so embarrassed. And also Paramount didn't want the headache that she was. So they kind of dropped her. And it just was a bad look. And then she promised her father she wouldn't talk to any magazines anymore. She failed at pretty much everything for a handful of years. And then she tried to take on Antony and Cleopatra, but she had no classical training and refused to be coached. And then she also butchered the text. She was like, in the scene where Cleopatra dies, I don't want the two handmaids to die. I want to die alone. And it's like, this is a Shakespeare play.
Yeah.
You can't really do that.
Yeah.
So then she met and casually married a guy named John Emery. He was in a play with her, and it was not a great play, but she had always said that when she met someone who had as big of a penis as Barrymore, who had flashed her originally to try to get that part, that she would never sleep with anyone else again. So I guess John Emery had a really big dick, and she kept the word that she would marry him and be with him because of his big dick. One of her party tricks, in fact, became to take people up to their bedroom when he was sleeping, pull back the covers, and show them how hung he was.
Oh, my gosh. That's
inappropriate.
Very inappropriate.
Inappropriate to Lula.
And, like, sounds like spousal, like, sexual abuse.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Yeah. And, like, for a few years, their relationship was good, but she said that his weapon was good, but his shot was weak. So the marriage was kind of on the rocks very quickly.
Okay.
Come on, Tallulah. But then in the 30s, she got what they thought was an abdominal tumor, but it wasn't. It was gonorrhea. She had to go into a 5-hour radical hysterectomy that she left the hospital at 70 pounds. But ironically told the doctor, "Don't you think this has taught me a lesson?" She's like, "It has not."
Oh my God.
No lessons here.
Well, I'm also like, frankly, her being her, I'm sure she's like, honestly, good riddance. Like, I didn't want that uterus anyways.
No, get it out of here. Get it out of here. But the hysterectomy kind of shook her a little bit. She was physically weak, so she was unable to perform, like, on stage. And then also, for a while, she was unable to be satisfied or, like, reach an orgasm. No. So I guess the surgery was just really rough on her body.
Yeah.
But she still had this unrestrained exhibitionism. She would throw her clothes off in public still and walk around. She would leave the bathroom door open at parties. She would perform with no panties on stage to the point where, like, people in the crowd were calling and complaining. All of her plays were her as, like, a Jezebel or a Hellcat. She's always that character. But then in the 30s, she goes out to be Scarlett in Gone with the Wind. And her screen test for the role was great. In black and white, everybody loved it. But in Technicolor, she photographed so poorly.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
They were like, no, you absolutely cannot do this role. Instead of that movie, though, she got the lead role in Little Foxes. She had to play a stoic war wife. And later that year, in March, because of that role, she was put on the cover of Life magazine.
Wow.
They said that it could have been impossible to find adequate parts for such an eccentric woman, but for the first time, this was a part big enough for her talent. And her, let me see, this is what Vanity Fair said, that her brilliant portrayal of the cold and ruthless, yes, yet feisty wife got her their Best Actress of the Year award.
Wow.
So getting turned down from Gone with the Wind was, like, good for her career.
Yeah.
Even though she was in the play, and then they gave Bette Davis the role in the film.
Oh.
Then she was in The Skin of Our Teeth on Broadway, which was a huge triumph. And then she was in Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat, which is another war drama where she's in a lifeboat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. They're, like, getting pelted with water. She actually had to stop filming for a while because she got pneumonia.
Oh,
and people said a lifeboat in the Atlantic is the last place you thought you would find Tallulah. But she was great.
Wow.
She was great. One more. Let's see. But at this time, the Allies are dealing with the war stuff in Europe. And I think that that's what kind of made this film so big. And then Tallulah starts to become political. And it really worked for her. Everybody knew she was a partier. And she said, "I'm not going to drink another drink until the Allies are back in Paris."
Whoa.
And she stuck to it. And then she campaigned for every single Democrat in sight. And then she helped Eleanor Roosevelt set up the Washington branch of the Stage Door Canteen in the early 50s. And then she fought against McCarthy and chasing after the communists. And she was super anti-communist, but she hated the idea of this, like, list, this McCarthyism, like, witch hunt. Mm-hmm. So she was, like, really outspoken about that. Back on stage, she was high camp and high comedy, but it was only going to last her a little while longer. They pulled her to put her on radio and in television ads, which people kind of liked, honestly. They wanted to see Tallulah and hear Tallulah in their home instead of having to pay to go to the theater or the like the stage theater or the movies. Finally, she writes her memoir. It's called Tallulah, My Autobiography. It was prickly. It was honest for its day. And it was really amusing. And it became a bestseller. "My interest and enthusiasm are too random for sustained devotion," she said. She also became close in this time with Tennessee Williams. Mm. And he wanted her to play the mom in The Glass Menagerie. And he tried to get her the role. And she even auditioned for it and did great. But they didn't give her the role because the studio was too worried about her drinking. Although she had already been a heavy smoker and a heavy drinker and a heavy consumer of sleeping pills, Bank had continued to perform into the 50s and 60s on Broadway, on the radio, on the television, and occasionally in film, even though her body is getting more and more frail. She even had a stage act in Vegas, which made her a ton of money. Around this time, Bank had begun to attract a passionate, highly loyal following of gay men, some of whom she employed as help in her life, and she affectionately called them her caddies.
Aww.
As she turned 50, her demons started to grow. Mm. She was drinking a quart of bourbon a day, mixed with a dangerous amount of pills. She was struggling with insomnia and took 5 pills a night just to sleep. She couldn't bear to be alone, so the men that were her young men who loved her called caddies. She would have them sit on her bed and wait until she fell asleep like a little pet. She wouldn't stop talking, around 70,000 words a day, because she just hated not being heard. And her housemaid even had to tie her arms together to stop her from taking too many pills.
Oh my gosh.
One person saw her in the hallway of her like hotel in New York, pounding her fists on the wall, barely even wearing a robe. And Orson Welles said, "She is the most sensational case of aging being unkind. I'll never forget how awful she looked at the end and how good she looked at the beginning."
Oh my gosh.
But at least her sense of humor didn't desert her. When somebody might ask, "Aren't you Tallulah Bankhead?" she would say, "Darling, I used to be."
Oh.
Or, "I'm what's left of her."
Oh.
To Tennessee, who had become her really close friend, she confessed, "I'm 54, and I wish always, always for death. I've always wanted death. Nothing else do I want more." She's still doing a ton of TV spots, and again, most people loved her. She even got a Tony Award nomination during this decline. This is in the 1961, when she's over 50 years old, when she's doing the stunts herself, including like sliding down these massive staircase banisters on stage. But it wasn't going to last as her addictions kind of took over her life. Mm-hmm. She ends up dying at St. Luke's Hospital in Manhattan on December 12th, 1968, at 66 years old. Mm. The cause was pleural double pneumonia. Her pneumonia was a complication due to her cigarette smoking and malnutrition. Mm. But it may have been made worse because there was a flu epidemic at the time. Her last words were a request, "Codeine, bourbon," she said.
Oh my gosh.
She was valued at $2 million at the time of her death, even though she said she had nothing, and she was buried near her sister's home in Kent, Maryland. She was unapologetic about her brilliance and her beauty and her imperfections, and like we said at the beginning, she was not a star. She was a blazing supernova.
Yeah.
Tallulah was a product of the 1920s jazz age dream. She was born into the failing Great South. She was trapped in Catholic schools. She was drawn in by vaudeville. She was scandal and passion. She was unapologetic about her love of excess. She never once called herself bisexual. She described herself publicly as ambisextrous instead. Bankhead amassed nearly 300 film, stage, and television and radio roles during her career, and she was inducted into the American Theater Hall of Fame in 1972 and the Women's Hall of Fame in 1981. One of her most famous quotes is what I'm going to leave us with. "If I had to live my life over, I'd make all the same mistakes, only sooner." And that's Tallulah Bankhead.
Wow, that story was like, I was like, not prepared for like how kind of depressing that was.
Yeah, at the end it like really goes downhill. She struggled to get she just struggled to transition from stage to film.
Yeah.
And from silent like movies to talkies.
And like from a young person to an older person.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just feel like
she's one of those, you know, like, you know, people are like, oh, you're an old soul. She was a young soul.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
She was like a rock star. She thrived on like sex, drugs and rock and roll and like wanted to be out at parties every night. And that catches up with you. Like,
yeah.
I'm lucky to make it to 9 now. And I'm only 37.
Oh, God. All right. Well, let's get another drink and talk about a doctor.
I can't wait.
We're back. Part 2. New cocktail. Multiple new ingredients.
You are going to the store this week, ladies.
I'm sorry, Miss Krista. But you live in the greatest city in the world, so you'll be able to find it. All right. Do you want to know what this cocktail is?
I have to know.
Okay. So this is called Mom's Place.
Cute.
It is rum, lychee milk, which I found again at the World Market, and it's, I don't know, like, I've never had this before, but it was called lychee milk, and preserved lemon juice. And then you shake that all up and you garnish it with a preserved lemon.
It kind of looks like a lemon drop, honestly.
Cheers.
Cheers. Mmm.
Mmm.
I like it. It's kind of bitter.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes more like a martini, honestly.
There's
like an olive juice taste to it a little.
Yeah. Mmm.
I like it.
Very interesting.
This is for like a slow sip business event.
Yes.
Not like a guzzling brunch.
No.
Yeah.
It's also like, I think also because of the lemon in it, I was expecting it to be like very citrusy, mm-hmm. and it's not.
Yeah.
I think the lychee is like overpowering.
Maybe, maybe. Yeah.
I don't know, but it's interesting.
Yeah. It's new.
Yes.
We got it. We're 5 years in. We got to mix it up.
All right. So what do you know about Dr. Margaret Chung?
I know she was a doctor and apparently in the Navy.
Yeah. Well, kind of.
Or like
she's
Navy.
A big supporter of the Navy.
Oh, a supporter of the Navy.
Yeah, she was a big supporter of the Navy.
Yeah,
very confusing.
I don't really know anything about her.
Okay, great. So I got most of this from a really great article in the LA Times by Cecilia Rasmussen, Wikipedia, and just some other like news articles, websites, because her story seemed pretty straightforward. So I hope I'm not missing anything big. But yeah, let's get into it. Margaret Jessie Chung was born on October 2nd, 1889 in Santa Barbara, California. She was the oldest of 11 children, born to Chung Wong, a foreman of the Rancho Guadalasca in Ventura County, and Ah Yane, who spent time in a mission home before working in agriculture and sometimes as a court interpreter. Both of her parents immigrated from China to California in the 1870s, but they were denied U.S. citizenship, so they had a difficult time finding stable work. And there was a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment in the U.S., which eventually gave way to the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. This was the first major U.S. law ever implemented to prevent all members of a specific national group from immigrating to the United States, and only helped fan the flames of discrimination that Chinese Americans were experiencing. So this is the U.S. that Margaret is born into. So for the first 13 years of her life, the family lived on the ranch where her father worked, and they were strict Presbyterians, and Margaret often helped to take care of her younger siblings, becoming a caretaker at a really young age. But she didn't mind because she found a great joy in helping people, and she really looked up to one person in particular. It was a family physician who lived on the ranch, and he would make house calls on his bicycle to all the families living there. And she just loved his dedication to like helping the families out and like really taking care of them, because frankly, nobody else was. So when she was 10 years old, she made the decision. She was like, I'm going to become a doctor just like him. This was difficult because she often had to skip school in order to take care of her siblings, but everyone said she was incredibly strong-willed and she wasn't going to let anything stop her. In 1902, the family left the ranch for Los Angeles, where her father found a job as a vegetable peddler. Margaret saw this move to LA as her chance to make something happen for herself. So she started working harder towards her goals. In 1905, she was noted in the Los Angeles Herald as a promising student. The leading quote from the article was, "Margaret Jessie Chung has aspirations." She was noted in the Herald again in 1906 for her poem Missionary Giving, delivered at the 18th anniversary of the Los Angeles Congregational Chinese Mission. So she's making a name for herself as just like a determined young woman. She really wanted to study at USC, so she knocked on the doors of hundreds of Los Angelinos, selling newspaper subscriptions that had won her a Los Angeles Times scholarship. That scholarship opened up academic doors for her, but she still had to work in the school's cafeteria. She was a waitress. She sold surgical instruments, and she would enter speech contests all the time just to earn prize money to make ends meet. During her undergrad time at USC, she was hailed as a particularly bright star, and she graduated in 1909 and enrolled in the USC Medical School in 1911. But she was fucking doing it. It was taking a long time, but she was doing it. And she was officially a medical school student. But of course, that couldn't be all she's doing. In 1914, her mother died of tuberculosis. So she had to help her father out and essentially also become a full-time caretaker. I don't know how she found the time, but she did it. And 2 years later, in 1916, Margaret Chung became the first American-born Chinese female physician.
That's incredible.
I know. Although you wouldn't quite know it, because for the class picture on graduation day, she put on a men's shirt and tie and slicked her hair back to look more masculine. And apparently this is something she often did while she was in medical school. Even though she was proud to be the only woman in her class, she frequently took on a different identity, going by Mike and dressing in a long blazer shirt and tie. But after she graduated and entered the professional field, she stopped doing this. I'm not sure exactly why, but she stopped.
And what year did you say she graduated?
1916.
Okay, so early.
So early. After graduating, she applied to be a medical missionary because she wanted to go abroad and help people. But her application was rejected 3 times by administrative boards because despite being born in the United States, she was still considered Chinese and therefore could not secure funds for missionary work.
Ugh.
She settled for work as a surgical nurse in L.A. at the Santa Fe Railroad Hospital. Months later, she was finally accepted at the Mary Thompson Women's and Children's Hospital in Chicago. Then she became the resident assistant in psychiatry for the first juvenile psychopathic institute of the state of Illinois at Cook County Hospital. And after that, she became a staff resident at the state hospital for the criminally insane. She was eventually appointed the state criminologist for Illinois.
What?
Yeah. But then in 1918, she was summoned. So this is all in 2 years. She accomplished all of
that.
She's
going all over the place.
Yes. But in 1918, she was summoned back to Los Angeles because her father was hit by a streetcar and had died. One source said that it's believed that he could have survived, but he was refused medical treatment because
he was Asian.
He was Chinese.
Oh, my gosh.
She returned to the Santa Fe Railroad Hospital, this time as a staff surgeon, and in her position here, she would often treat celebrities. Fun fact, she removed Mary Pickford's tonsils.
That is fun. Somebody had to do
it. Somebody had to do it. In 1922, she decided to move to San Francisco's Chinatown and open up a private office there. She treated the local Chinese population there and had a pay-what-you-could system for them, which was sometimes nothing for the poorest population, but she was okay with that. She just wanted to be of service. And this was also a really important service for this population because many of them were still being treated with traditional Chinese herbal medicine. And this was both because they were used to it, you know, it worked for them, but also it was often their only option because many Western medical practices run by white physicians, which that was most of them refused to see them. So it was another option for people in this population. So she is treating this underserved population, but then she is also becoming even more of a physician to the stars. She treated people like Sophie Tucker, Helen Hayes, and Tallulah Bankhead.
No way!
She was her doctor.
No way. What did she treat her for in LA? Do we know?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know, but she was her doctor.
This is that like gap of time when she's living in Hollywood after she was in London.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so funny.
Then in 1925, San Francisco's Chinese hospital opened and she led the gynecology, obstetrics, and pediatrics unit as one of the four department heads. Then Margaret started treating Navy Reserve pilots. And because many of these men were in the military, so away from their homes and their families, she started to take extra care of them. She felt that these men were being underfed, so she started including home-cooked meals as part of her medical care.
Aww.
Many of these men started to call themselves Mom Chung's fair-haired bastard sons.
Oh, how cute!
She developed really close relationships with a lot of these men and referred to them as her adoptive sons. She even gave them all jade Buddha necklaces to wear around their necks so that they could recognize each other when they were literally flying around the world.
That's so cute. Oh, that's a tearjerker. They're in little sorority.
Well, because she was like, one of the problems with, like, especially people in the military is like you lose that sense of community, especially like when there's actual conflict happening, like you're being sent all over, like you don't know where you're going. Like, so then if you're like, in a bar in the middle of like this random place and right. you're like, oh, you know, Mom Chung. It's really sweet. She was really into like community building and making sure that like they felt connected to other people.
Yo, Tallulah needed a bit of that.
Yes,
just
she
a
did.
Little bit. Just a, like a little dose.
Yes. Non-aviation naval officers adopted by her. This is so cute. Were called Golden Dolphins. So these are the Navy people that didn't fly. Uh-huh. And one famous Golden Dolphin was actor Henry Fonda. He was one of her sons. But all of these men, and there were nearly 1,000 of them, simply called her Mom or Mom Chung. When Japan invaded China in 1937, she volunteered as a frontline surgeon, but she was secretly assigned instead to recruiting pilots for the first American volunteer group, better known as the Flying Tigers. Okay. So she's recruiting pilots, and that, you know, is adding to her, like, developing this really intense sense of community. And she continued to mother for her sons whenever they came into San Francisco. She would serve up to 175 people at Thanksgiving at her house, and she wrapped and addressed 4,000 gifts at Christmas. The walls of her red and gold office were covered with their cables, photos, souvenirs, letters. The gifts they sent her included bits of aircrafts from famous disasters. So she had a fragment of the plane that crashed in Alaska, killing humorist Will Rogers and Wiley Post. And she also had a fragment from the 1937 explosion of the Hindenburg.
No way.
Yeah.
What a cool piece of history to have.
I know. All of her sons had numbers attached to them so she could keep track. And another notable son was number 131, Ronald Reagan.
Okay, don't brag or anything.
Some of her sons started to include high-ranking officers and congressmen because obviously, like, they're moving up through the Navy program and becoming these bigwigs.
Oh, yeah.
And she used her connection to them to help establish the Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service, a.k.a. the WAVES, which was the Women's Naval Reserve. So she was like, we need to have this. And she wanted to join because obviously she loved the Navy and her Navy boys, but she was not allowed. Some say that is because of her Chinese ancestry, but it was more likely because she was a lesbian. Mom Chung was a private person, so, you know, we don't have too much of this from like her own point of view, but she did have some pretty intense correspondence with two of her supposed lovers, and that was writer Elsa Gidlow and entertainer Sophie Tucker, who you may remember was one of her patients. And I also wonder if this is why Tallulah saw her, because like maybe she was like, you're gonna, even though I'm sexually free and, you know, doing whatever I'm doing, like, I know I can come to you for medical treatment and not be judged. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wonder if that was part of Tallulah's thinking.
Well, I'm also sure that someone like Tallulah could think she could get arrested.
Yeah.
It was illegal to be gay. Yes. It was illegal to have abortions. Like, these were not things that, like, you could just get away with.
Mm-hmm.
I know, exactly. Like, we spoke light of it, like, mm-hmm. with the first half of the story, but, like, she was lucky that she didn't get arrested.
Yes, 100%. So Dr. Chung retired from medical practice within 10 years after the end of World War II. And to recognize for her for all she did, her sons banded together and bought her a house in Marin County for her to retire in.
Of course they did. That's so what cute boys.
They're good boys. Margaret died on January 5th, 1959, at the age of 69 years old from cancer. World War II naval hero Adam Chester W. Nimitz, a Golden Dolphin, was a pallbearer. Although her name is not commonly known, you can see her legacy in various places. She reportedly served as inspiration for the character of Dr. Mary Ling in the 1939 film King of Chinatown, portrayed by Anna May Wong.
Woo!
And
my favorite.
At least three flying fortresses were named Mama Chung in her honor by her adopted sons during World War II. She was commemorated with a plaque in the Legacy Walk Project on October 11th, 2012. This is an outdoor public display which celebrates LGBT history and people. And a tunnel boring machine for the San Francisco Municipal Railway's Central Subway was named Mom Chung in 2013. But of course, I don't think she did any of this to get accolades of any kind. She just had a calling to help people in any way that she could. So whether it was taking your tonsils out or cooking a homemade meal when you really needed one, Mom Chung was always there.
Oh,
it's a really short story, but I thought it was so fun and sweet. And
it's so heartfelt.
I know. I adore it. And I wish we knew more of her.
Yeah, like, I adore that.
I want more information.
Yeah.
Well, what we need to do now is talk about these two ladies in conversation with each other in a little segment we like to call
Just the Two of Us.
Okay. These are wildly different women.
They're wildly different, but it's so strange how similar. Like, her parents were immigrants, and, like, Tallulah's dad was from Ireland. Mm. But it was just the differences of being able to present as white, you know, at a specific time in the United States. Mm-hmm. Their backgrounds were just brought differently.
Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting, like, seeing, like, you know, Margaret is the oldest and has to, you know, take care of everyone, you know, and she had to be so responsible versus Tallulah, who is the youngest. She's having to take care of herself. And, you know, there's a point where, like, she didn't have to be as responsible as Margaret did because, like, there's no one for her to take care of. She was supposed to be taking care of herself, but, like, she just wasn't really doing that.
No.
You know? Mm-hmm.
But both girls still, at a really young age, knew what they wanted to do with their life. 100%. They were like 10 years old and were like, okay, this is what I want to do. And they both got on the train to that specific occasion. Yeah,
they really
right
did.
Right away.
And they also, like, needed help funding their dreams. So I felt like they both kind of, like, had scholarships, or, like, you know, Tallulah had, you know, won that contest.
Donors.
And, or, like, another donors. And, like, that was, like, their big help. So, like, these are also, like, we see what Tallulah did is very fluffy and, like, whatever.
Like,
she's
vamp.
Just getting by on her charm. But also, like, I do think there's some hard work going on.
Absolutely.
And because, like, obviously she loved to party. But also it's, like, I think that she felt in a way that, like, she couldn't stop. Or else, like,
I'd be forgotten.
Her whole life would fall apart.
Yeah.
She would be forgotten. If she didn't go out the next night, say something witty to the papers, she would be gone in an instant. Like,
yeah.
I think that she felt that kind of pressure. And obviously, like, Margaret also felt that, like, if I don't stop chasing my dreams, like, I am just going to fall to the wayside and, like, become like my parents, just, like, working, raising 11 kids. And she was like, I don't want to do that.
And they also, like, both in their early careers were totally pigeonholed. Like, they were like, okay, Margaret, you can only be a nurse.
Yeah.
And Tallulah, you can only act in this type of role. And it was like, then they would get criticized. It's like, you're too good to do this job, but you're not good enough to do this job. And they were both very frustrated by that because they were talented women.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that, like, later on, you know, I was thinking about Tallulah's caddies versus Mom Chung's, like, sons and her Golden Dolphins. Like, it's such a different type of relationship that they had with these kind of, like, doting men.
Right.
You know, and I just think it's interesting that, like, near the end of their lives, they're surrounded by these, like, men who want to help.
Yeah.
You know, but unfortunately for Tallulah, it's like, there's not really much they can do.
Mm-hmm. She was, like, too far gone at that point to be able to get 100% better.
Yeah.
But they both, like, had these queer identities in different ways. Tallulah was very forward and upfront about hers. Mm-hmm. She notably in her lifetime was said to have had over 500 sexual partners. And there have been, I mean, I watched a lot of videos about that. Like, it's I mean, not only is it like sexually dangerous because we didn't know a lot about all the sexual diseases, like sexually transmitted diseases and stuff, it also back then was like really frowned upon.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that Margaret kind of kept it private because she couldn't have gotten away with it the way that Tallulah did.
No, because she's a minority.
Right. Like, exactly right.
At the end of the day, like, Tallulah is a person who is like in the entertainment industry. She's a white woman. Like, it's almost like, oh, that's just Tallulah. Where it's like Margaret, she was, and like, I think that the Navy like appreciated her enough to not like really blast this, but like, she wasn't allowed to join the program that like she had helped start because they knew that she had these same sex relationships.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's upsetting, the double standard that like you have two women living at the same time and like Margaret is trying to keep it on the down low and Tallulah is just blasting it everywhere.
Yeah.
And
it must have been so frustrating to people like Margaret to see people just be so open about it when you can't.
Yeah. Because the consequences are different for her.
Right.
And she knew that they were.
Yeah.
No matter how much she did for all these white Navy men.
Yeah. It's like, they also both died in their 60s, like really young.
Yeah.
And so sadly, because they were, they could have both been going other places.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were also both connected to a ton of famous people. Like, oh, there was so much name dropping in this episode that I absolutely loved.
I could have gone on for days. Mm-hmm. It was crazy.
Yeah. I don't know. Just, I think these women's, they, their lives touched countless other lives.
Oh,
whether
yeah.
it is, she fed me at a time when I was really low and like didn't have another place to go and I felt really lonely.
Right.
Or I went to a party and that bitch really made me laugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's important for both types of people to exist in this world. Like, I don't want anyone to suffer what their Tallulah went through because
right.
that's a lot, you
it's
know.
It's terrible.
That's a hard, hard life to live,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think Margaret really loved her sons, you know, and for two women who also never had kids.
Yeah, no kids.
Yeah, neither of them. And
no kids, one marriage.
Yeah.
This is a light episode. Really light, really light. Well, her Tallulah's sister got married 7 times, so it makes up for it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We could do a whole episode just on her.
But yeah, it's interesting then, like, seeing two women who, yeah, never got married and how they kind of still had these like rich lives, mm-hmm. like, you know, because I think a lot of people see that as kind of end game, and like these two women are like, no, for very different reasons, you know, or like, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And
not my
know.
vibe.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, Tallulah and Margaret.
Loved it. What a fun night.
Who would you like to toast this evening?
I'm gonna toast to people who just get away with it.
Yeah.
I just, like, as a teacher, I know. Mm-hmm. There are kids who just do stuff and I'm like, eh, whatever. There are people who just get away with it. And that's what Tallulah was.
Yeah.
She could get away with anything she wanted to.
Yep. If you got that charm, you got
it.
She's
got it.
Oh my gosh. Cheers.
Who would you like to toast?
I'm going to toast the women who are moms, even if they've never given birth or adopted or anything like that. Just like people who know how to mom, because it's a very specific skill. And I love people who have that natural instinct.
Yeah.
So
cheers
to them.
The momming.
All right. Who would you like to toast? I mean, who? We already did toast. Sorry. What are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
So I want to give a real shout out to food courts. I think malls have really lost their way, but the food court is strong. Food court game is strong.
The food court game is strong because you know what the mall lacks is a central bar.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
And I love that about like modern food courts. Yeah. It's like there's usually like a big bar in the middle and then you can eat whatever you want.
Yeah, I think the thing that I love the most was, so we went homecoming dress shopping last weekend for the girls and we just had to stop and get some food.
Oh, so you're talking about a legit mall food court?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Like, I am saying malls are dead, but this was great. This was a great experience. And we all got something different.
Yeah.
We stood in four different lines with four different money, got what we wanted, all sat down together and ate, and it was delightful.
That's why I love, like, the modern, I guess they're called food halls.
Yeah, the food hall, like our house.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. It's nice. It is nice.
It is really nice. And I love just, like, getting the food, and, like, none of the tables are, like, assigned, so you just sit wherever.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know. I like, I do, I love a food court.
They're so, so great. Mm-hmm. Like, the marketplace down in, like,
Mount Vernon.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's another really great one. Mm-hmm. I just, it was really refreshing to not have to fight over where to get food after waiting for like an hour in line at a dress store.
Yeah. Perfect.
What are you into?
I'm going to promote a movie called, I think it's, I can't remember if it's The Hitman or Hitman, but it is basically, it just came out recently. It's on Netflix and it's a really nice, brisk, like hour 40 minutes, which I love. A
perfect. Short perfect movie. Timing. Perfect timing.
It's a good short movie. And it's about this guy who's like kind of like an IT tech guy, and they need him to fill in for the guy that like does the sting operations, like pretending to be a hitman. So they can like catch people who are like trying to kill their spouses. And this is based on the true story of a guy who was like very unassuming. But when he got this job as an undercover hitman guy, he just like came into himself, and he would tailor each of these stings to the person that was trying to hire him. So it would be like, okay, well, like this guy is kind of like more of like a hunter, a fisherman guy. So he goes, I'm going to be that for him, you know? And he like put on a costume and an accent. And he's like, this is a woman who's like scared to death of like whatever. So he was like, so I'm going to be like this really like intense Russian guy. Like it's really... That sounds terrible, what I just said. But it's a really fun, jaunty little movie. If you're looking for something quick that's not going to take too long, never gets too serious. And it was, and it's funny. It's good.
Good.
So,
I love that.
Hitman. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate you. And if you would like to show us a little bit of appreciation, join us on Patreon, rate and review us, do whatever you can. It all helps the show. But yeah, we love you. We hope you're having a good week. And most of all, we want you to never forget that well-behaved women
never have a crew of adoring young men.
No. And they rarely make history.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.